It is most important that the company learn and experiment. If the company doesn't experiment early on, then by the time the technology is inflecting in its growth, with a market that is sizable enough to move the needle for the incumbent, it is too late. By that point, the smaller companies that took the time to master the new technology are much more nimble and experienced, and will outcompete incumbents in what have become big growth markets. If an incumbent misses enough of these growth opportunities, its offerings will become obsolete, its revenue will dwindle, its market capitalization will shrink, and it will become a dead-end investment. Often, these are referred to as value traps. As the innovative investor might expect, the fall of incumbents is happening at an accelerating rate, as is the rise of new winners. The disruption of incumbents can be quantified by how long the biggest companies stay in the S&P 500, or their average lifespan. The average lifespan for companies in the S&P 500 has fallen from 60 years in the 1960s to below 20 years of late. This is clearly a sign that investors must not be complacent. One cannot assume that the companies succeeding today will continue to be the leading and profitable companies for decades to come. Disruptive technologies are also being invented at an accelerating rate. The trend is one we have been witnessing for millennia. For example, between AD 900 and 1900, a new general-purpose technology was invented roughly every 100 years, with notable examples including the steam engine, automobile, and electricity. In the 20th century, a new general-purpose technology came into existence every 15 years, with familiar examples like computers, the Internet, and biotechnology. In the 21st century, general-purpose technologies have come into existence every 4 years, with autonomous robotics and blockchain technology as two of the more recent examples. While disruptive technologies tend to unseat incumbents, there are examples of companies that have managed to reinvent themselves continually for decades. Just as there is danger, there is also opportunity for incumbents to capitalize on exciting new growth markets, which can boost their revenue and market capitalizations. Discerning the difference between a value trap and a reborn incumbent can make all the difference for the innovative investor. Blockchain technology in the financial sector. In 2016, the father-son team of Don and Alex Tapscott published the book Blockchain Revolution: How the Technology Behind Bitcoin is Changing Money, Business, and the World. And William Mugayar published the book The Business Blockchain: Promise, Practice, and Application of the Next Internet Technology. As the titles imply, these books discuss the many ways in which blockchain technology is currently and will continue to disrupt how business is done worldwide. In this chapter, we investigate a few ways the financial sector may be upended by crypto assets and how incumbents are responding. Using the financial sector as a leaping-off point, investors can then apply their learnings to other industries. The financial industry must slog through a swamp of regulation, sometimes making it slow to adapt to new technologies. Recently, the industry has been showing its age with numerous data breaches, near-monopolistic structures, and continued use of tools and models developed decades ago that still run the inefficient money systems in place today. However, the Tapscotts believe the days of Frankenfinance, that convoluted, contradictory, and often irrational system of finance we've lived under for so many years, are numbered as blockchain technology promises to make the next decade one of great upheaval and dislocation, but also immense opportunity for those who seize it. Recall from Chapter 2 that not all instances in which blockchain technology is used necessarily involved a crypto asset, such as Bitcoin or Ether. In fact, thus far the majority of companies in the financial services space have opted for blockchain implementations void of crypto assets. It is increasingly common for these implementations to be referred to as distributed ledger technology, DLT, which differentiates them from the blockchains of Bitcoin, Ethereum, and beyond. For companies pursuing a DLT strategy, they still utilize many of the innovations put forth by the developers of public blockchains, but they don't have to associate themselves with those groups or share their networks. They pick and choose the parts of the software they want to use and run it on their own hardware in their own networks, similar to intranets, earlier referred to as private, permissioned blockchains. We see many DLT solutions as band-aids to the coming disruption. While DLT will help streamline existing processes, which will help profit margins in the short term, for the most part, these solutions operate within what will become increasingly outdated business models. As we will cover with insurance, incumbents could use public blockchain architectures to provision similar services to what they do already, but it would cannibalize some of their revenue. Such cannibalization is admittedly painful, but as Christensen lays out, it is often necessary for long-term survival. Additionally, regulation can handcuff the incumbents, and in the financial services industry, incumbents are particularly sensitive to regulatory rebukes after the financial crisis of 2008. The incumbents protect themselves by dismissing crypto assets, a popular example being J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon, who famously claimed Bitcoin was going to be stopped. Mr. Dimon and other financial incumbents who dismiss crypto assets are playing exactly to the precarious mold that Christensen outlines. Disruptive technologies bring to a market a very different value proposition than had been available previously. Generally, disruptive technologies underperform established products in mainstream markets. But they have other features that a few fringe and generally new customers value. Products based on disruptive technologies are typically cheaper, simpler, smaller, and frequently more convenient to use. Disruptive technologies like crypto assets initially gain traction because they're cheaper, simpler, smaller. This early traction occurs on the fringe, not in the mainstream, which allows incumbents like Mr. Dimon to dismiss them. But cheaper, simpler, smaller things rarely stay on the fringe, and the shift to mainstream can be swift, catching the incumbents off guard. Remittances and blockchain technology. One area long discussed as ripe for disruption is the personal remittances market, where individuals who work outside of their home countries send money back home to provide for their families. The market is massive, with the World Bank reporting worldwide remittance flows north of $600 billion, though it admits that the estimate is conservative. The true size of remittances, including unrecorded flows through formal and informal channels, is believed to be significantly larger. Most remittances originate in high-income countries and are sent to individuals in developing countries where the banking systems may not be easily accessible. As families in the receiving countries are typically unbanked, without access to a bank account or direct wire transfer capabilities, companies that provide a solution serve as a lifeline between the remitter and his or her family. For many years, companies such as Western Union and MoneyGram have used their lifeline position to levy high fees on these remitters, as they are among few options available and provide a mission-critical service. For example, toward the end of 2016, the global average fee for a remittance was just shy of 7.5%, with the weighted average coming in just under 6%. These fees are decreasing, and rightfully so. In 2008, the average fee was nearly 10%, which meant that someone with $100 to send home only ended up giving $90 to his or her family, while the remitting company took the other $10. It hardly seems fair. Some call it exploitation. As more competitors enter the market in the internet era, people realize there is little reason for such high fees to be charged. While the term wire money may make it sound like the company providing the service is doing something sophisticated, in reality there's no wire. This is an outdated term from the days when Western Union was a telegraph company, literally using wires to send messages. Those wires are long gone. For the most part, All that happens in a remittance is a few centralized entities rebalance their books, debiting one account and crediting the other, after taking out a large chunk of the original amount, of course. It's no stretch, then, to recognize that Bitcoin, with its low cost, high speed, and a network that operates 24/7, could be the preferred currency for these types of international transactions. Of course, there are requirements to make this happen. The recipient needs to have a Bitcoin wallet, or a business needs to serve as an intermediary to ultimately get the funds to the recipient. While the latter option creates a new age middleman, which potentially has its own set of problems, thus far these middlemen have proved to be much less costly than Western Union. The middleman can be a pawn shop owner with a cell phone who receives the Bitcoin and pays out local currency to the intended recipient. In India, the largest receiver of remittances in the world with 12% of the global remittance total, a recent partnership between Bitcoin exchanges is projected to bring the fee down to 0.5% for remittances into the country. In Mexico, there's been a huge surge in volume at the country's Bitcoin exchange, Bitso, where funds can be transferred for a similarly low fee. All of these companies are eyeing the tens of billions of dollars the incumbents make from levying fat fees on vulnerable customers. The impact of this major disruption in the remittance market should be recognized by the innovative investor, not only because of the threat it creates to a publicly traded company like Western Union, WU, but for the opportunities it provides as well. For example, Bitso secured startup funding through the online investment service BankToTheFuture.com, which, as we discussed in Chapter 16, connects investors with crypto asset startups. Business-to-business payments and blockchain technology. Sending money internationally goes beyond citizens, as businesses also transmit large volumes to global business partners. While this industry is too large to dive into every detail, the same story laid out in remittances applies. Fees are generally higher than they should be, and payments are slower than they should be. Visa, for example, has sensed the opportunity and is working with a startup called Chain to build a business-to-business payment solution using blockchain technology. BitPesa is another company that leverages Bitcoin to help companies in Africa. Currently, Kenya, Nigeria, Tanzania, and Uganda send and receive global payments. Ripple has been a popular startup for incumbents to work with, and some of them are creating projects that utilize its native asset, XRP. Incumbents such as Bank of America, RBC, Santander, BMO, CIBC, ATB Financial, and more use Ripple's blockchain-based technology to achieve faster and more secure financial transactions. If realized, these efforts could not only reward the companies that utilize Ripple, but also potentially benefit Ripple's own crypto asset, XRP, which can be used as a bridge currency to help settlements on the Ripple network. The innovative investor will want to monitor how cheaper money flows may create opportunities for new and existing businesses in emerging markets. Capital fuels the growth of industries, and if money moves more freely between citizens and businesses, that may induce a significant economic boom in developing markets. This too may warrant an investigation of which geographies stand to benefit the most, as many ETFs and mutual funds can be purchased for exposure to targeted geographies. Geographic diversification can benefit a portfolio when isolated macroeconomic dislocations strike. Insurance and blockchain technology. Thus far, most insurance companies have opted to investigate DLT implementations and have not ventured far into the world of crypto assets. Large consulting firms are competing to be viewed as thought leaders on how distributed ledger technology will change the insurance industry, as these firms hope to win valuable contracts with deep-pocketed insurance companies that need help navigating the potential disruption. Deloitte believes that a blockchain could allow the industry as a whole to streamline its processing and offer a better user experience for customers who have to make a claim. Simultaneously, storing claims and customer information on a blockchain would cut down fraudulent activity. Innovative investors can get a leg up on which insurance companies may be good short-term investment candidates and which to avoid based on the action they take, given the predictions of well-respected consulting firms. That said, as we have already mentioned, we view many of these DLT implementations as band-aids to prolong the life of systems that will fade into obsolescence over the coming decades. For the long-term investor, careful analysis should be undertaken to understand if insurance companies are pursuing DLT use cases that will provide a lasting and meaningful solution. Lastly, some of the major consulting firms may be so entrenched in incumbent ideology that they too may be blind to the coming disruption. Recall from Chapter 5 that there are already companies like Etherisk providing decentralized insurance policies. The disruption can go beyond the capital raising and claims management processes of insurance companies and into the risk models themselves. For example, Augur's prediction platform built on Ethereum allows for markets to be created around the outcome of real-world events. The predictive applications for this platform in the insurance area are varied and could have a direct impact on the actuarial industry, which is an integral part of the insurance industry and currently defines its pricing models. Options exist for insurance companies to find a happy medium using the solutions provided by crypto assets. For example, Factum has implemented a smart contract platform that allows for the creation of insurance policies with improved security and identification capabilities. Peter Kirby, the co-founder of Factum, points out that his platform can protect policyholders from fraud and identity theft, or at least provide them with the ability to track down the perpetrators of fraud and identity theft through the immutability provided by the blockchain technology that his platform is built on. Cutting down on fraud and identity theft would help the bottom line of many insurance companies tremendously. Furthermore, operating in the transparency of public networks would do much to bolster trust in their operations, which could draw more customers. Don't rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. In the days immediately after the 2016 election of Donald Trump as U.S. president, the stocks of companies in the financial sector rallied in expectation of the new president's potential policy shifts from that of the prior administration. During that time, investors benefited from having financial stocks in their portfolio, and perhaps many more put these stocks into their portfolio after the election, either on the advice of advisors or as a reaction to the financial media claiming financial stocks were bound to benefit in the age of Trump. However, focusing on these short-term trends is like rearranging the deck chairs on a sinking Titanic. The innovative investor should ask if these gains were due to actual policies or the expectation of these policies, which hadn't yet been implemented. Policies can be temporarily effective at reinforcing the financial status quo, but are only stopgaps in the face of long-term secular trends. It's important to recognize the disruption that Bitcoin and crypto assets can bring to the entire global financial system. Armed with this recognition, the innovative investor should consider the long-term investment prospects of financial companies clinging to their current operating models without consideration or recognition of the impending disruptions that these technologies will bring to the sector. The bottom line is that rather than fretting over where to position their deck chair, investors should consider if they should be long-term buyers of these existing banks and financial firms, given what they know about blockchain technology and the potential it brings to significantly change the banking industry. Three potential strategies for survival. We list three general strategies incumbents will likely use in their attempt to capitalize on the potential of blockchain technology. If you can't beat them, buy them. Toward the end of 2015 and through much of 2016, It seemed as if every single financial services firm was waking up to the potential of blockchain technology to disrupt its industry. When incumbents feel like they are late and being outmaneuvered by startups, they simply buy or invest in the startups. That is precisely what happened. The list of incumbents investing in Bitcoin and blockchain startups accelerated to a frenzied pace starting in late 2015 and continued through the first half of 2016, including Citi, Visa, MasterCard, New York Life, Wells Fargo, NASDAQ, Transamerica, ABN, AMRO, and Western Union. While the investing or takeover strategy has been a go-to for incumbents trying to avoid disruption, it is rarely as effective as hoped. Once the big company swallows the startup or begins meddling, it is often hard for the startup to retain its fast-moving and flexible culture. Nimble cultures are key to succeeding in the early stages of a disruptive technology. And if the startup is tainted by corporate bureaucracy, then it will quickly lose its edge. Circle the wagons. Industry consortiums have been extremely popular among incumbents investigating how to apply distributed ledger technology to their industry. On one hand, a consortium makes perfect sense, as a distributed ledger needs to be shared among many parties for it to have any use. A collaborative consortium helps financial services companies, many of which have historically been competitors that keep their business processes close to their chest, learn how to share. On the other hand, these consortiums can hit snags if too many big names and big egos become involved. One of the most famous consortiums is R3, which launched on September 15, 2015, with big names such as JP Morgan, Barclays, BBVA, Commonwealth Bank of Australia, Credit Suisse, Goldman Sachs, Royal Bank of Scotland, State Street, and UBS. By the end of September, 13 more financial companies had joined, including Bank of America, BNY Mellon, Citi, Deutsche Bank, Morgan Stanley, and Toronto Dominion Bank. Before 2015 was over, 20 other financial companies joined R3. R3 consists of the leading financial companies in the world, many of which are held either in individual equity or bond positions in portfolios, or are in managed money investments like mutual funds and ETFs. Another consortium, the Hyperledger Project, offers more open membership than R3. Remember, one of the strengths and defining aspects of an effective blockchain project is its open source ethos. The Hyperledger Project was launched in December 2015 under the umbrella of the Linux Foundation to create a collaborative and open source platform that could work with many industries, not just financial companies. Companies currently supporting the project include Airbus, American Express, Daimler, IBM, and SAP. The project states, Hyperledger members and staff are committed to sharing best practices and providing assistance with the use case development, proof of concept, POC testing, and adoption of Hyperledger. Initial efforts undertaken by the group are in the finance and healthcare industries, with plans to build supply chain solutions as well. It will be interesting to see how this cross-industry collaborative and open-source effort proceeds and what results come of it. An innovative investor will do well to follow the group's efforts to help identify specific companies that may benefit from the results. One of the more interesting recent consortiums was the Enterprise Ethereum Alliance. It went public in late February 2017, and its founding members include Accenture, BNY Mellon, CME Group, JP Morgan, Microsoft, Thomson Reuters, and UBS. What is most interesting about this alliance is that it aims to marry private industry and Ethereum's public blockchain. While the consortium will work on software outside of Ethereum's public blockchain, the intent is for all software to remain interoperable in case companies want to utilize Ethereum's open network in the future. Create an innovation lab and leave it alone. The third strategy that an incumbent can follow is known as an innovation lab. Several universities, including Harvard, have set up innovation labs as a way to foster innovation through a collaborative effort between students and businesses. The corporate world has also jumped on this unique way of providing a forum for nurturing creative ideas with solid business skills. Often these innovation labs are left alone or largely untouched by the incumbent parent, perhaps following Christensen's advice. With few exceptions, the only instances in which mainstream firms have successfully established a timely position in a disruptive technology were those in which the firm's managers set up an autonomous organization charged with building a new and independent business around the disruptive technology. In the 21st century, the innovation lab concept has been embraced most famously by Google, which encourages creativity and innovation beyond an employee's current position. The company has created the Google Garage as a somewhat formal structure in which employees can pursue innovations with others in the company. This has resulted in projects such as its autonomous vehicles effort that Google has grown organically in the hopes of providing additional future revenue. A key feature that needs to be reinforced from Christensen's quote is the need to set up an autonomous organization. Just setting up an innovation lab within a company is not a guarantee of success. These labs must be allowed to function as autonomous organizations without the tunnel vision of existing business and profit models. The greatest opportunity still awaits. We believe the greatest opportunities for investment growth are in public blockchains and their associated assets. It is the companies that stretch themselves to work with crypto assets that will benefit the most over the long term. If instead a company pursues its own DLT solution, investors must decide if that solution will enhance the value of the company in the long term. The opportunities are endless and will be only limited by the ingenuity of visionaries, developers, and business leaders. It will be an exciting time for innovation, and potentially a rewarding time for those innovative investors who are equipped to recognize the opportunities that lie ahead. Tax reporting of crypto asset gains. Any financial professional or successful investor knows that managing an investment portfolio requires an understanding and approach to the tax ramifications, both on the gain and loss side, when making investment decisions. These types of strategies should also be part of innovative investors' approach to crypto assets within their portfolio. While some decisions have been made related to the tax treatment of these assets, overall, there's a lack of clarity, and even worse, a lack of understanding by the agencies providing tax guidance. As crypto assets gain more publicity and acceptance, rest assured that government regulators and tax collectors will take more and more notice. All crypto assets have a value, and when bought or sold can create a gain or loss for the innovative investor. It should come as no surprise that the Internal Revenue Service, IRS, of the United States, has made clear its desire to get a cut of this digital pie. In 2014, the IRS decided it understood Bitcoin and issued guidance on its tax treatment with IRS Notice 2014-21. Without detailing the fine print of the ruling, the basic message was that, although Bitcoin may be called a virtual currency, for tax purposes, the IRS would treat it as property. For example, stocks, bonds, and real estate are also considered property. The guidance stated, general tax principles that apply to property transactions apply to transactions using virtual currency. Therefore, an investor, or even a casual user of Bitcoin, must treat it for tax purposes the same way they would stocks, bonds, and real estate. A capital gain in any of these assets would warrant a taxable event. Accordingly, capital losses could be utilized as well. The bottom line with Bitcoin, either for transactions or investing, is that the purchase and sale prices need to be tracked. The difference will be capital gains or losses, with appropriate tax treatment based on long or short-term holds. The regulation also addresses income paid in Bitcoin and even the mining of Bitcoin, which are treated as immediate income at the market value of Bitcoin at the time of possession. The 2014 IRS guidance is interesting because, although it rules primarily on Bitcoin, it refers to virtual currency such as Bitcoin. Does this mean that the ruling includes all crypto assets in the virtual currency classification? Here's how the guidance defines what it means by virtual currency. In some environments, virtual currency operates like real currency, that is, the coin and paper money of the United States or of any other country that is designated as legal tender, circulates, and is customarily used and accepted as a medium of exchange in the country of issuance. But it does not have legal tender status in any jurisdiction. Looking at IRS Notice 2014-21, which provides a bit more information on tax guidance related to Bitcoin and virtual currency, we find an attempt at further clarification. Virtual currency that has an equivalent value in real currency, or that acts as a substitute for real currency, is referred to as convertible virtual currency. Bitcoin is one example of a convertible virtual currency. Bitcoin can be digitally traded between users and can be purchased for or exchanged into U.S. dollars, euros, and other real or virtual currencies. In this case, Bitcoin is considered a convertible virtual currency. The ruling also refers the reader, who is by now rather confused, to a more comprehensive description of convertible digital currencies that was provided by the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, back in 2013. Although the FinCEN opinion has less to do with taxation and more to do with addressing the misuse of digital currencies for illegal activities, it reveals the fact that numerous regulatory agencies in the United States have been unable to provide clarity and a unified voice on how to classify Bitcoin and crypto assets. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, also entered the fray when it charged a startup seeking to offer Bitcoin-based options for not registering the product with it. This defined the asset as a commodity, not property, which would then be covered by the Commodity Exchange Act, CEA. The CFTC Director of Enforcement, Aitan Goldman, tried to clarify his opinion with this statement. While there is a lot of excitement surrounding Bitcoin and other virtual currencies, innovation does not excuse those acting in this space from following the same rules applicable to all participants in the commodity derivatives markets. It is clearly confusing that the Director of Enforcement of the agency that ruled Bitcoin a commodity also called it a virtual currency. If some crypto assets are commodities, this could open them up to different tax treatment than if they were considered solely as property. Commodities fall under the 60-40 tax ruling, meaning 60% of the gains on a commodity transaction are treated as long-term capital gains, and 40% are treated as short-term capital gains. This is different from taxing stocks, where profitably selling an equity after 12 months is classified as a long-term capital gain, with a current tax rate cap of 15%. Selling prior to 12 months would be considered a short-term gain with the tax ramification based on an investor's income bracket. All crypto assets are not alike. There needs to be further clarity and understanding of these assets by government agencies and potentially a new set of regulations, including tax treatments, that recognize these differences. For now, the IRS and the CFTC view these assets differently, and this will surely necessitate further clarifying rulings by the IRS to provide appropriate direction. Don't expect this to happen quickly. It took the IRS over 15 years to provide tax guidance on derivatives. For now, the course to take regarding tax treatment of these assets should rest with the investor and their accountant. The IRS considers them property, and therefore recording a gain or a loss in a similar manner to equities or bonds seems the prudent path to take. Neither of us is an accountant, and we can't forecast how governmental regulators will ultimately reconcile the issues. Regarding taxes, the first thing investors should do is to discuss any Bitcoin or crypto asset activities with their accountant, and lean on the accountant for information and advice. Second, and probably most important, is to keep records of all activities with these assets. This should include not only buys and sells, but if an asset was used to purchase a good or service. It can be as simple as maintaining a paper-based or Excel spreadsheet that tracks the date and price of an asset when acquired, and the same information when sold or when purchases are made with that asset. In time, more detailed reporting tools and resources will be available from the more reputable exchanges and from startups creating tools to track, record, and provide resources for blockchain tax reporting. Even though the rules regarding taxation of these assets may change, one thing is clear. As with any other asset, the IRS is watching. Chapter 18. The future of investing is here. Throughout this book, we've tried to provide historical context on investing and crypto assets. Hopefully at this point, there's a clear recognition that crypto assets should be evaluated alongside other traditional and alternative asset classes. Just as with any other asset class, there are good crypto asset investments, and there are bad ones. Considering these investments requires the same level of due diligence and research as does any other potential investment. Although investment opportunities in crypto assets are growing, currently most access is available through the purchase and trading in individual crypto assets on exchanges. As we outlined in Chapter 15, some capital market investments currently exist, and more will come to market in the future. What form these investments will take is yet to be seen. Will they be mutual funds made up of various crypto assets? Perhaps an ETF that invests in an index of a specific slice of crypto assets, like a focused privacy portfolio of Monero, Dash, and Zcash. Already opportunities for investors to gain access to hedge funds that actively manage different crypto assets, including the latest ICOs, are arising. But maybe the hedge fund structure will largely become a relic of the past, with asset management infrastructure decentralized through platforms like Melonport. The potential products and vehicles are endless and provide investors and money managers with great opportunities for profit. Will individual money managers become famous for their expertise and active management of these assets? Or will passive investments consisting of rules-based categories of crypto assets become the vehicle of choice? In the 1980s, Fidelity's Magellan Fund was where investors wanted to place their money, and it was all because of one person, Peter Lynch. During Lynch's time, the fund grew from $20 million to $14 billion, and he beat the S&P 500 index 11 out of 13 years. It was a heyday for active managers and for mutual funds in general, and investors chased money managers, not stocks. This enthusiasm for specific money managers wasn't isolated to equities in the 80s. As recently as 2015, much was made about bond guru Bill Gross's departure from PIMCO to Janus, as PIMCO found that 21% of its total assets left when Gross did. 25 years after Peter Lynch left Fidelity, many financial pundits and writers have criticized his techniques, specifically his buy what you know advice. This was a cornerstone of his philosophy, as he bought stocks based on products he used as a customer, experiencing the company's business model in the flesh. In clarifying his famous comment in the face of criticism for active management, Lynch stressed the need for fundamental analysis of any investment. "People buy a stock and they know nothing about it," Lynch said. "That's gambling, and it's not good." For the innovative investor, recognizing that no investment should be made with little to no knowledge is not only sage advice, but common sense. Here's another Bernanke-Tater rule. Don't invest in Bitcoin, Ether, or any other crypto asset just because it's doubled or tripled in the last week. Before investing, be able to explain the basics of the asset to a friend and ascertain if it fits well given the risk profile and goals of your investment portfolio. The Millennial Age of Investing. We've provided a substantial amount of historical context in this book as it relates to investing in crypto assets. Many long-time investors may regard this information as a reminder of how they formed their own investing approaches and strategies, often having learned the hard way. For these investors, taking the step to considering and potentially investing in crypto assets may be an evolution in their own investing strategy as they become innovative investors. However, a segment of millennials recognizes these opportunities and are becoming newly minted investors through their forays into crypto assets. Much has been written and hypothesized about millennials, or those that entered adulthood around the turn of the century. Millennials have an entirely different approach to banking and investing than baby boomers who invested through the dot-com crash and the financial crisis of 2008. Having come of age through market crises, millennials are surprisingly conscious of their financial well-being. A recent study conducted through Facebook found millennials are highly educated, and perhaps due to the student loans required to gain this status, their financial situation is an important consideration in their life. In fact, 86% of millennials put money away each month. Equally interesting, according to a Goldman Sachs survey, 33% of millennials think they won't need a bank by 2020. Seeing these statistics, it's no wonder that many financial institutions are seeking ways to engage the millennial banking and investing client. The problem is that the business models of many wealth managers are not positioned to cater to millennials. Over the last two decades, wealth management firms have encouraged their financial advisors to sign up only investors with $250,000 in assets and move away from servicing all levels of investors. The reasoning has been to allow advisors to provide better service to a smaller base of clients, which is also good for profit margins. However, this means that their client base is aging. Because of these business policies, they are now less able to acquire and support young investors who are perhaps most in need of their assistance. Perhaps when wealth management firms were shifting millennials to online investing sites rather than providing them access to personal financial advisors, they were doing this to address the disruptions that millennials were bringing to their model. From a business perspective, it was a more cost-effective way to support this demographic. However, this approach addressed rather than engaged the demographic. Further research is making it clear that millennials are concerned enough to talk about their financial futures, sometimes more so than their baby boomer parents. A study from Transamerica reports the following. 3 out of 4, 76%, millennial workers are discussing saving, investing, and planning for retirement with family and friends. Surprisingly, millennials, 18%, are twice as likely to frequently discuss the topic compared to baby boomers, 9%. This from a generation that watched their parents significantly impacted by the Great Recession, either through downsizings or losses in investment portfolios. Many of them consider the stock markets akin to gambling casinos. However, they also recognize the value of saving, investing, and planning for the future. Wealth management firms that believe online investing sites will placate millennials until they get older and wealthier and reach the minimum for a financial advisor relationship are missing the point of disruption. As many of the wealth management firms have ignored them, millennials may be turning their backs on these firms as well. And not surprisingly, they're looking for investment vehicles and firms they can feel comfortable with. In fact, a digital native generation likely has little problem accepting the value of a digital native asset. A recent article in Huffington Post had this to say. Millennials, assisted by a cadre of impressively socially awkward Bitcoin startup VC types, are piling intellectual and financial capital into this whole cryptocurrency idea. Bitcoin, Ethereum, all of it. What E in front of any noun did for techie investor excitement in the 1990s, crypto and blockchain seems to be doing today. Are millennials turning to Bitcoin and crypto assets for their investments? Is a Vanguard fund or a small investment in Apple any better? Whereas the Vanguard fund has a minimum investment amount and buying an equity will require a commission, Millennials see crypto asset markets as a way to begin investing with a modest amount of money and in small increments, which is often not possible with stocks or funds. The important point is that at least they're doing something to invest their funds and build the groundwork for a healthy financial future. We have seen firsthand millennials who have learned about investing from buying crypto assets and have implemented investing approaches, such as taking profits at certain price points, seeking diversification into multiple assets, and so on. A local Bitcoin meetup will include not only computer nerds discussing hash rates and the virtues of proof of work versus proof of stake, but also deep and financially sound discussions among participants of various ages about recent crypto asset investments. Goldilocks years of crypto assets? We may be at a point where millennials recognize the opportunity that crypto assets provide, while most of Wall Street, including the typical investor, financial advisors, and the majority of large institutional investors, haven't jumped on the crypto assets bandwagon. But they are watching. Certain large investors are even dipping their toes in, implying an increase in investment vehicles could be around the corner. Institutional money managers stepping up to crypto assets and creating investment vehicles will have a huge impact on the awareness of these assets within a wider population of investors. The need to fund these investment vehicles will also impact the demand for crypto assets, potentially putting significant upward price pressure on the associated markets. The benefits to the innovative investor who is already well positioned with a crypto asset portfolio could be substantial. It should be noted that when more institutions become involved and more information outlets come to life, the crypto asset markets will become more competitive. Right now, a well-educated and astute innovative investor still has an edge in the crypto asset markets. That may not always be the case. We're in a Goldilocks period for crypto assets, where the infrastructure and regulation has matured considerably, but most of Wall Street and institutional investors have yet to enter the fray. Therefore, there's still an informational and trading edge for the astute, innovative investor who enters these markets now. This is a chance to get on board before the entirety of the investing world wakes up to this opportunity. Taking the step forward with the knowledge we've provided and a firm grasp on one's financial plans, goals, and objectives will be what separates an innovative investor from the typical investor. Being an innovative and ever-learning investor. Along with skyrocketing all-time highs, the number of crypto assets available has surged. The growth of ICOs and resultant proliferation has gone beyond what any reporter or follower of this industry can keep up with. Crypto assets are a moving target. While this is true for any asset class and any investment, the crypto asset target moves faster than most. That's why we've armed the innovative investor with the ability to understand and evaluate these assets through historical context and time-tested investment tools and techniques, such as modern portfolio theory and asset allocation. Innovative investors are active participants in their financial future, but this doesn't mean they must be alone on that journey. Relying on the advice of financial professionals can be effective because they can provide research and direction. Yet while innovative investors may take advice from experienced professionals, the final decisions are their own. They adapt their investing approach, strategies, and even selections based on what is occurring around them. This is especially vital in the age of exponential change that we're living in. Buy and hold works until it doesn't. Investing for the long term works until there's a need for income in retirement. Times change. The markets go up and the markets go down, sometimes in drastic ways. Situations change. A sick relative or job loss can create havoc with any financial plan. Innovative investors are all about choosing their own investing philosophy, their own investing approach, and having their own viewpoint on what is a suitable investment for their own situation. It's not about dismissing the opinions of others. Rather, it's about evaluating the advice of others from a solid, educated, and informed base of knowledge. We've taken the innovative investor on a trip through the world of crypto assets and its colorful history, one that's still being written. It's a fascinating world to be a part of, and for those new to it, we hope that we've provided a good entry point. For those already part of this world, we hope we've expanded the view. We're excited about the opportunity it provides, not only for investors, but for the larger community as well. We believe that when Satoshi was creating Bitcoin, he was also creating a view of the future. We hope that with this book, we've been able to elucidate that future just a little more and provide you a means to be a part of it. Because that future is here. This is Dave Clark for McGraw-Hill Professional. Thank you for listening. This audiobook is copyrighted in 2018 in the name of Chris Berdisky and Jack Tater, and is based upon the book Crypto Assets, written by Chris Berdisky and Jack Tater. Copyrighted in 2018 in the name of Chris Berdisky and Jack Tater. To purchase other McGraw-Hill Professional audiobooks, please visit Amazon.com. To purchase other McGraw-Hill Professional products, please visit our website at mhprofessional.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.